Hello, RAFV. You're listening to the Who's Who with Stu podcast, and I'm Chris Studebaker, CEO of the Realtor Association of the Fox Valley. On this podcast, we'll be chatting with important stakeholders in the Fox Valley community, finding out the scoop, and sharing it with you.
First up, we have Ron and John, Stats and Trends, starring Ron Donovan, chairperson of the TechCom committee, self-professed stats nerd, and realtor at Keller Williams Inspire, and John Broadbooks, chief communications officer at MRED. We will explore and discuss current housing market stats and trends and what's going on in our local markets. Take it away, guys.
Good day, RAFV. I am here with John Broadbooks from MRED. Let's talk about some numbers, John.
So yeah, we do have some numbers though to talk about.
Absolutely.
You know, it's kind of interesting. So one thing I would point out to anybody who's an MRED subscriber is we look at things on a week-to-week basis. We have what we call our weekly market stats report, which we do email out to our subscribers, but you can also find it on our website at mredllc.com. And so, you know, InfoSparks, you know, looks at numbers a month at a time. We still have a few days before we get the full picture of the March numbers, but looking at the sort of the week to week, you know, the median price of a home throughout our network was about $295,000. And that number is up year over year. Closings generally a little lower than the past year, but not bad. I think we had 2,161 last week alone, again, throughout our system, not just in RAFV. And that's about 240 closings off the previous week. And if you look at the last 4 weeks, we're off about, you know, maybe 20% compared to the last year. But so, you know, while the downside is maybe that there are fewer closings, the good news is that prices are certainly higher. And, you know, at least I guess that's better for realtors. And yeah, I don't know. Better for you, Ron?
Better on the short run, but we don't want this to continue. You know, we really, really don't. And I think the 20% fewer closings based on working with buyers is really supply driven. If there was the full supply, closings would be above, right? I think that number would be going up, but we just don't have the inventory. So I'm thinking about interest rates are going up, prices are going up, and the folks that get squeezed are the folks that are on the lower levels of our prices. What does that mean for the first time buyer?
Yeah, I got to tell you, I feel for first time buyers right now because it's just become such a competitive environment. So there are really sort of three layers to this, if you think about it. It's almost like the Hunger Games of housing, right? So let's say you're a first-time buyer. You're going to have to save up money for a down payment. Depends on what program or what financing you can get. But, you know, so you come up with this nest egg that you can use for a down payment. At the same time you're trying to save up this money, you're also, let's say your employer says, you know, after 2 years of not having to work in an office, you're now going to have to return to the office a couple of days a week or maybe permanently. So suddenly you're having gas prices in there. We all know what's happened with gas prices. Food prices are also going up. And you know what? Even if you're a renter right now, you're seeing prices creep up. I mean, we track average rental or medium rental prices. And, you know, in some weeks we're seeing jumps of $150 to $160 a month, sort of year over year. So, you know, that's putting a squeeze on you if you're trying to do that. And Ron, you can talk about the financing because, you know, even when you look at sort of what the interest rates are doing, it has an impact.
Yeah, I saw some numbers late last week. So back in early 2019, the average mortgage price, everything included, taxes, interest, the payment itself. The average payment was $1,593 to start 2019. Currently, the average price of a mortgage or your average monthly mortgage payment is $2,193, $530 up in 2 years. That's 33%. That's amazing and scary. And talk about a squeeze. You use the word squeeze. That's a squeeze.
Yeah. Well, and let's say you get through this sort of, you know, dual hit of rising interest rates, rising prices, Let's talk about the fact that there's just so little on the market that's going to be in the price band that you're probably looking at. I pulled some numbers on DuPage County, not to pick on DuPage County. I love DuPage County, but just thought it as an illustrative example.
Whether it has snow in it or not, you love it.
Right, exactly. I do. Last month, if you look at houses that were right around the median price point and lower, there were only 262 homes to choose from last month.
In the whole county.
That's about 300 fewer than there were at the same time last year. So literally, you're going to have to be competing with people. I mean, I joked about, people are lining up around the block. And Ron, I think you said they actually are in some cases. Mm-hmm. In DuPage County last month, there were 28 shows to contract. And it took about 8 days to get a contract on the median. So 8 days. I mean, you got to move so fast.
Well, and those 28 showings are over just a couple of days. I saw a house disappear in 7 hours last weekend. They had an open house on Saturday at 11 o'clock. And at 6 o'clock, I got an email message that said, hey, if you're going to make an offer, you need to do it now. And by 9 o'clock, it was contingent on the MLS.
And I mean, it really brings up a question. You're beginning to see some chatter in the national media about, well, are we in a housing bubble? You know, is this a housing bubble? Makes for a really good headline, I suppose. I'm not going to sit here and tell you whether the market is overheated, isn't overheated, but I will tell you that the dynamics right now, I think, are substantially different than you saw in 07 and 08. In 07, 08, I mean, even as we went into this, there were still a lot more homes on the market than we currently have now. I mean, in 2008, there were 100,000 homes for sale, right? In some parts of that year. And now we're sort of under 13,000 throughout our area. Yeah, right. So, I mean, that just shows you just how depleted the market is. The prices are rising. No doubt about it. I mean, we're up about 9.25% this past week on median prices versus last year. So, I mean, you're definitely seeing the increases. Look, I'm not an economist, but let's also factor in that a lot of the 07-08 bubble was driven by, shall we say, in some cases, questionable lending practices. That definitely played a role because you could walk in with almost no money or frankly no money down and end up with a house. Mm-hmm. That's not the dynamic we're seeing this time. And again, not to say prices aren't rising rapidly, but there are just a lot of different dynamics that, if you're just reading a headline and you don't really sort of understand and look further, you're not going to understand there's a big difference between the two markets.
Right. Yeah, I'm reading the same things, hearing the same things for the most part. Bubble is not a word that that folks are using. Good to know. Anything else, sir, that you'd like to discuss today? That's some good stuff, some good numbers.
Yeah, I think it's good, but I my best wishes to anybody who's a first-time buyer out there. I really want you to be able to do it. And, this is something that, NAR has been really concerned about, being able to get first-time buyers into houses. NAR has been very concerned about it. Certainly, the state association has worked on legislation on its end to try to sort of address this problem somehow legislatively. And, there's a lot of concern even among some of the groups like the National Association of Hispanic Real Estate Professionals, which does an annual report. I mean, they're concerned about this. So it cuts across a lot of different groups. And it is something that, is not going to be fixed probably very quickly because we're just not building enough houses to meet the demand.
Wow. Yeah, I think those numbers that you gave us for DuPage, 300 fewer homes on the market right now, and the number of homes on the market is 262.
That's, right.
Ouch.
Yeah, that's insane. So
yes, it is.
If you see something, you better move as quickly as you can. So
it's supply driven. John, hey, thanks so much. Appreciate your time. Have a fabulous weekend down there in the balmy middle of
it. In the tropics here in Springfield. That's right. Yes. And enjoy the snow, Ron. I know you will. Get your snowblower out. Yeah. Happy spring.
Thanks, John. We'll talk to you soon.
All right.
Thanks, guys. Next up, help me welcome Annalise Fierstos of the Illinois Realtors Legal Department. She will be taking us through one of the main questions she receives on the Illinois Realtors Legal Hotline. Annalise, take it away.
So much, Chris. My name is Annalise Fierstos. I am the hotline attorney at Illinois Realtors. I can be reached over the legal hotline or by email, and the information, all of my contact information, is on the Illinois Realtors webpage at illinoisrealtors.org. One of the very hot topics this past 6 months on the hotline has been about virtual offices in the state of Illinois. And I will say that the department, IDFPR, has been very excited about the addition of virtual offices as a legal concept in the state of Illinois, because we are actually the first state to recognize that real estate brokerages can run businesses out of virtual offices. And I think the department is very proud of that situation. So the virtual office concept, the definition of a virtual office actually, is an office without a dedicated office space or fixed physical location, like a website. But there are some parameters there that everybody needs to keep in mind if they think that they are going to move from a brick and mortar office into the virtual world. The virtual office is not just operating off of a laptop. And we've had discussions at Illinois Realtors, the legal team, with IDFPR about the establishment of virtual offices. And we have been urged by the department to share with our members that it is very important for licensees to recognize that just using a laptop to run your business does not mean you have a virtual office. The Act and the rules that accommodate the Act have been drafted to make it very clear that a virtual office must have a digital infrastructure that facilitates the transaction of business communications, advertising, and real estate through the virtual website, URL, or other digital platform that invite the general public to transact the business. So in other words, I get a lot of calls about from people, particularly post-COVID, because we've all moved into a more remote kind of business model. Can I just shut down my brick and mortar office and start meeting people at Starbucks? And is that and go virtual and I'll be virtual? That is not how this works. If you have a virtual office, you need to visit with a professional, help them set up that website. And the website needs to meet a lot of requirements, and those are outlined under the administrative code. And I'm going to give a cite, so grab pen and paper. Under the administrative code, the rules section 1450.610, it is very clearly outlined what is necessary to have a virtual office as a licensed brokerage in the state of Illinois. One of the first things to remember is a virtual office has to be registered with the department on their webpage. So just like a brokerage has an entity license, a virtual office will have an entity license. And the virtual office, just like a physical office, needs to have a designated managing broker assigned to that office and identified to the state. So identified to the department. The department also needs to be provided an accurate physical address for that designated managing broker and a correct phone number for that managing broker and a correct email address. And that is because in the event that somebody did, and let's hope this would never happen, obviously, did file suit, somebody needs to be served in the lawsuit with a complaint. So they need to be able to physically access that managing broker. And so that would be for service of process. Security is a huge issue. And I would anticipate that that will be an issue that the department will focus on quite a bit when people start really operating out of these virtual offices. And so you really want to use a professional to help establish a system for secure electronic files. And they need to be maintained in the format in which they were originally generated, sent, or received. So in other words, you can't develop maybe some kind of a spreadsheet and just put the information from the files into your secure electronic files. You need to be able to maintain them in the fashion that they were received. And if the department makes the request to the virtual brokerage for, you know, pursuant to an audit or some other reason to investigate the files, the brokerage needs to have the ability to provide those files in an electronic fashion in response to the department's request within the 24 hours of that request. All electronic files maintained by the brokerage need to be backed up monthly, and that's another security feature that is very important. And all of the records, electronic records that are related to the escrow accounts must be securely stored for a minimum of 5 years. Now, here's the trick with the virtual offices. You know, the act was passed in 2019 allowing virtual offices to exist in the state of Illinois in our real estate world. And then the rules were passed. And it took a little while to get the rules defining what these virtual offices look like. And the department is still playing catch up. So their IT department is still setting up both the registration process for the virtual offices and the manner in which they can audit virtual offices. So it's still coming along. And so that's unfortunate. I know a lot of people are really, really anxious to get this going. But one thing to understand is that if you're going to do a virtual office, you need to be able to do it in the right way also. And so, you know, you're going to have to hire a professional and create this web page and deal with the security issues and really figure out what you are doing as a licensee or a brokerage if you're going to work this way. So the time might be a little bit of a blessing because it'll slow everybody down a little bit. And instead of taking a giant leap and just operating with an office that isn't as secure as it needs to be, or doesn't allow access to the licensees, because that's another requirement. Your licensees need to be able to enter and leave this office virtually. And so that's another access issue that needs to be established. So there are some things that are going to take a little while to develop. And so even though we're anxiously waiting for the department's final word that people can start making their registration, some patients is required because it's not quite ready to go yet. But keep an eye on the Illinois Realtors webpage and our regular blogs and our posts and blasts that go out, because as soon as the registration is up and running on the department's page, we will get that information out as soon as possible. And so keep an eye on our page and look for our updates on virtual offices. Thank you so much, Chris. It was very nice talking today, and have a wonderful day.
Thanks, Annalise. Great information as always. Up next, I'll be speaking with former Lieutenant Governor and current candidate for DuPage County Clerk, Evelyn Sanguinetti. Talking today with former Illinois Lieutenant Governor Evelyn Sanguinetti. In addition to her time as Lieutenant Governor, Evelyn has served on the Wheaton City Council. You've served as the Assistant Attorney General. Until recently, you were the Executive Director at Hope Fair Housing, which is fantastic. I saw one of your bios, moniker of human rights activist, which for a Republican is kind of interesting. Now, you don't see that very often. So I might ask you to talk to me a little bit about that. But one doesn't become a self-proclaimed human rights activist without an interesting story. So I was hoping that maybe you could give us a little bit of background of your history and where you came from, where your family came from, and how you got into wanting to be an attorney and you know, in the public service.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. My story is not your typical story, but it's definitely very American. My mother is from Fidel Castro's Cuba, and my father is from Ecuador, and both families came to the United States for that American dream. And today we'll be talking about property interests. Well, to Latinos, the big American dream is having that piece of the pie, having a piece of land that you could call your own. So my parents meet in Hialeah, Florida as young teenagers. Mom was 15 and I came soon thereafter. So that painted my backdrop with regard to property and human rights, because it's always been my belief since birth that where you live pretty much translates everything that's going to happen in your life thereafter. Where you live determines the proximity to world-class healthcare, wonderful schools, you know, oh my gosh, schools, education, but then most of all, you know, where you live, your proximity to the highway so that you could get to work and so on.
Very nice. We're talking today with Evelyn Sanguinetti, former Lieutenant Governor of Illinois, and current Republican candidate for DuPage County Clerk. So that's an interesting segue from, you know, usually you get to a constitutional office and, you know, you've kind of reached the peak and you're coming back to the countywide office. You want to talk a little bit about that and tell us how you got into coming back to do county politics.
Well, I got started locally. Sure. I got started on the Wheaton City Council. And I would submit to everyone that all things are local. It was during my service in the Wheaton City Council that I was able to go to meetings, speak to neighbors, find out what was important to them, and then go to meetings and make determinations in their life. Like for instance, sidewalks. Sidewalks were a big deal to me. And most recently, I was at a Republican event and there was a woman holding a cane, a mom. And she also walked kids across the street, a crossing guard, and she said, "You're the sidewalk lady, aren't you?" And I said, "I sure am," even though my husband tells me to lose that name. I said, "Sidewalks are very important." And she says, "Oh, it's very important to me. Thank you for what you did." So now that I am no longer your lieutenant governor, there is the seat that is very important. And you know, the county clerk, people hear the word clerk and they're like, that's not sexy, that's not sensational, it's just clerk. But if you take a look at the duties of the clerk, they're incredibly important. They're in charge of the election commission. They're in charge of vital records. All of those records, right before a closing or right before you sign up to a new school that you need, vital records, all of that is kept in the clerk's office. And so they're legal instruments, and it's very important to have somebody that is incredibly competent to be over that, as well as the election commission. What interested me was the election commission. Madam Clerk, I'm sure she's a wonderful lady, but I have seen some shortcomings, particularly the last election that it was, in my opinion, botched. And because of that, coming from that Cuban background I told you, if you don't have your elections, you don't have anything. And we didn't have it in my mom's country. And so, well, at least fair elections. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I thought that this would be a wonderful opportunity to transform that office. I think about things in the way of transferability. If you take a look at my background, I went from musician to attorney, to elected official at the statewide level, at the local level, and now I'm in the county level. There are certain skills that throughout your life you could use to serve the public, and those skills are transferable.
Well, that's interesting. I missed the musician part. What instrument do you play?
Well, that was my big break in life. So I grew up in underserved schools, right? Mm-hmm. As we were talking about property, and I failed the first grade, so my mom was my shiro. She always told me, "En este país tú vas a subir como la espuma. In this country, you will rise like the foam." And she bought me a used piano to keep me out of trouble. As a child, like most children, I was a little troublemaker.
That's
and
fantastic.
So, yeah, I got started in piano and found my way out through education in music.
Well, that's fantastic. The when did you decide that law school was calling you to go to law school?
You know, the calling came from outside. It all worked out that I was in schools that I was disinterested and uninspired, and I told you about failing the first grade, but my mom always told me, if you study hard, an opportunity will come, and you gotta be ready to pounce, even if you're nervous. And they said that there was a school of the arts in Miami, Florida, and that if you went there and they let you in by way of an audition, that your first 2 years of college were free.
Wow.
And, right, and so when I told my mom, "I'm gonna do it, mommy, I'm going," she told me, wait, you're going to college? Because it was not a discussion we had at home, because who could afford college? They would have been ever so proud just just with high school. So when I got into that school of the arts, I found access, I found opportunity. And based upon that, I was able to finish my 4-year degree, and it was at Florida International University. I just played a Scarlatti Sonata in a recital, and I went to the cafeteria, and I saw all these kiosks. And I said, hey, what are you guys doing here? What are you selling? And they said, well, we are accredited law schools throughout the United States. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to lunch. I'm the musician. And they said, no, musicians do really good in law school. And I was like, okay, give it to me. And then they said, well, how many hours do you play in the practice room every day? 6 to 8 hours. What do you think you're going to do in a law library? And then I said, okay. And then they said, and you prepare so that you could perform in front of a jury of your peers, which is your musical audience. What do you think you're going to do in front of a judge and a jury?
That's a pretty good salesperson right there.
Yeah. John Marshall Law School is still looking for that salesperson. Yeah. So that's how I got in and transferred from music. But it all has to be about those transferable skills, right?
Absolutely. So where did... Where did your calling for what you call, you know, your activism happen? Like, what started that, and how did that develop within you?
Yeah. Okay. So that is very very emotional, because my activism really started in law school when I was able to join the John Marshall Fair Housing Legal Clinic by way of this provisional license that you could get through the Supreme Court. It's called a 7-Eleven license. And my husband and I met in law school, so we were both in the clinic. And we handled a case, the case of Gabriella McCutcheon. And it was the first source of income discrimination case. And she was a beautiful black woman with two gorgeous girls. And she came to us with her situation. And as you know, victims of discrimination, it takes a lot to get up there and speak truth, right? And she told us that she was a voucher holder, and that was legal money, good money, but that the landlord turned her away because the landlord did not believe a voucher to be an adequate source of income. It wasn't a paycheck. And so because of that, we took on the case, my husband and I, and we won that case. And it was a case of first impression before the Chicago Commission on Human Relations. And after that, I finished my stint in housing in law school, and I knew that I wanted to serve, and I wanted to help those that were not in positions to uproot themselves and go to nicer neighborhoods so that their kids could have what a lot of us do have. So that's how the human rights activism started.
Very interesting, very interesting. Until recently, you were at Hope Fair Housing in Chicago, was that in Wheaton?
Downtown Wheaton.
Downtown Wheaton. Tell us a little bit, I know you're no longer there, but tell us a little bit about that organization and what their, you know, what their charge is.
So Hope Fair Housing is the largest and oldest fair housing center in all of Illinois. And what I always want to say we, because I just finished leaving Hope Fair Housing as its executive
director. I'm sure they don't mind if you continue
my gosh,
to connect.
And they know I am here today, and I will forever be a Hope Fair Housing Center supporter. But what we do is fight housing discrimination and segregation in all of its forms. So let's say right now you're in a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. And you want to be able to live in the housing of your choice, and you certainly have the resources and the credit and everything, but you're in a wheelchair and the landlord or the seller doesn't want to sell to you for that reason. That violates the Fair Housing Act, and the Fair Housing Act is a federal law. And so what we do is we're divided into two different departments. Hope does its outreach, which is great because a lot of people, and you're in the real estate industry, they want to do good, mm-hmm. but they don't know what the Fair Housing Act says. So you nip it in the bud, right, wrongdoing through education and outreach. So we're divided into those two arms. Nafia Lee Khan is actually the person who directs our education and outreach at Hope Fair Housing. Your new executive director is the amazing Michael Chavarria. And then we also have another wing, which is the enforcement wing. And in the enforcement wing, what Hope does is train and deploy testers.
Okay.
And testers are like secret shoppers. Somebody calls, says that something happened, that they believe that they were victims of housing discrimination. Well, that's an intake call. We do that first. And then sometimes we train and deploy testers to go out to those locations, not to test for discrimination, but to test for differences in conduct. If we find that there are differences in conduct, then we may use that as evidence in many tribunals that exist throughout Illinois. You have federal court, you have HUD, you have the Illinois Department of Human Rights, and so on. So those two divisions are wonderful, and throughout the pandemic, I will tell you that that we got a lot of calls. Mm-hmm. And I believe that a lot of landlords probably thought that fair housing went to sleep, but it didn't. It was places like Hope that were able to fight for people.
So understanding, you know, in our industry that you know, fair housing is a continuous issue, something we always have to work towards fixing and solving, right? How can realtors be better or do better or be advocates for fair housing? Because you have a different perspective, which I think is fantastic. So it'd be interesting just, you know, if you could, you know, grab them by the shoulders and kind of shake them a little bit. What is it? How can they be better advocates for fair housing from your perspective?
Well, there is a beauty in diverse communities. And there is a beauty in diverse communities, more so for my children, because I want them to grow up in those communities. When I speak to people in the real estate industry, my first recommendation is to avail yourself of the knowledge that is available, because most people are outright good, but they just don't know what the Fair Housing Act provides. So if you take a look at the Illinois Department of Human Rights website, for instance, they do tutorials, and mm-hmm. those are free. Otherwise, you could call Hope Fair Housing. They'll get out here, and that will be free too. And hablamos español. So what I would recommend is avail yourselves of that free information, and it will seriously prevent other problems coming down in the future. Because again, we're all good. We mm-hmm. just don't know what the Fair Housing Act says.
Oh, that's great information. I think we'll definitely have to make some phone calls and make those introductions, because I think that would be helpful. Well, fair housing is something that's near and dear to your heart. Did I read somewhere as well that human trafficking has also kind of come into one of your areas of interest that you're advocating on to help or fight against?
Well, you will, if you look at my background, you will see that I fight for the underserved in so many different categories. When I started as your lieutenant governor, the 47th lieutenant governor, another issue that was big to me was food uncertainty. Because education is a big deal, but if you're hungry at school, you're not learning. Mm-hmm. Another big part was rural affairs and making sure that our rural communities had access to all the things that we have access to here. But as of late, when I was the executive director of Hope, we had Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And what we did was showcase legislation that helped women in peril. For instance, these women wanted to run from their aggressor, but they didn't want to break a lease and ruin their credit. So during COVID-19, they were stuck at home with their aggressors. Well, it was through Hope Fair Housing that we advocated and let the victims know about the legislation and what they had the power to do. After I left Hope Fair Housing, then we also showcased the whole issue of human trafficking. People think that human trafficking is an issue in Bolivia, Venezuela, Budapest, anywhere but the United States. And that is simply untrue. You see a lot of it here. So we did for a whole month a lot of advocacy, and we did a big event. But in a lot of the work that you see that I do is to help the underserved. It feels good.
Well, that's absolutely true. The interesting part to me is that you have your background and your passion sits within this. I don't like the word activism, but in some, you know, it's definitely community involvement. It's definitely where you're out there and you're trying to make a difference, and I really think you are. Tell me, how does the clerk's office help you kind of continue that mission, or how do you continue that on? Because you seem very passionate about those things.
Well, when I win and I become DuPage County Clerk, I do plan to do that education, that outreach, and that advocacy that is so needed in the area of voting, getting into those high schools, as early as grade schools, to tell these children about public service, to tell them the role that they could have in their communities, if and only if they get involved. Getting into those classrooms and talking to my fellow Latina little girls to say, it all starts here. You get active in the whole process, and one day you too could be the next first Latina lieutenant governor in the entire nation. So I think that it is a beautiful position. Even though the term clerk sounds boring, not sexy, not sensational, I'm telling you, when I get there, I'm going to turn those lights on.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, I thank you so much for your time today. I wish you luck in your race and future success. It seems like you're very passionate about everything. I'm sure you can do whatever you put your mind to.
Es verdad. It's so true.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
Thank you again, RAFV, for tuning in to our podcast, Who's Who with Stu. If you have a topic you'd like us to discuss, please email me at chris@rafv.realtor. That's chris@rafv.realtor. Until next time, this is Chris Studebaker signing off.